40 minutes, and I want to tell you a bit about my friend Dean. Now, Dean has been on this campus since 1984, and he and I were in the same department as colleagues for many, many years before I became the dean. And Dean has done a lot of interesting things, and I want to tell you one of his talents is that he is a visionary. He thinks outside of the box. When he came to Point Loma, there was no journalism program, and he founded that journalism program. And throughout the years, has seen it expand and expand and expand, and he's done some other very interesting things during that time. He founded not only the journalism program, but also the Writers' Symposium by the Sea. And in that context has brought in many, many interesting speakers, such as Bill Moyers, Amy Tan, Jim Wallace, Kathleen Norris, and he has interviewed all of those people at the Writers' Symposium, where those interviews have been taped and aired on KPBS, our public radio station here in San Diego. So I don't have to go to the Writers' Symposium because I can sit at home in my comfort and watch it on TV, which is quite a privilege. Dean has also traveled all over the world to do all kinds of interviews. He's been and he's written about his experiences in all kinds of journals, including the New York Times, the Boston Globe, Christianity Today, Sojourners. That's just the tip of the iceberg. And it's a privilege to introduce to you today Dean Nelson, who has his PhD from the University of Athens, Ohio. And I remember when he went to do his PhD, he did it in 2 years. It took me 6 to do my PhD. So that'll tell you a little bit about Dean's tenacity, and I appreciate that trait in him. It's a privilege to introduce to you our speaker, Dean, who likes to remind me that I've only been the dean for about 2 years, but he's always been a dean. So without further ado, I would like to let's greet Dr. Dean Nelson.
Thank you, Kathy. Boss. Yeah, I guess I could have taken 6 years to do my degree, but why? One of the things that I wanted to get into with you today, if I could, is a little bit about the work that I did with John Polkinghorne. And I did a book with Carl Giberson called Quantum Leap, How John Polkinghorne Found God in Science and Religion. And some of that I just found very, very enlightening. I'm, as Kathy said about herself, I'm not a scientist. I was a pre-med major in college, but then, organic chemistry, okay? 2 words, all right? Do I need to say anything beyond that? No, probably not. But anyway, I did this book with about Polkinghorne, and the idea for it started with Giberson, who I had been writing for the magazine that Carl, one of the magazines that Carl had been editing called Science and Spirit. And I had done a number of stories for Science and Spirit about the persecution of monks in Tibet. I had gone to Tibet and stayed with them for several weeks. And I also did some stories on the Dalai Lama when he was at Stanford. Did some other things about contaminated water in Central America. And even did a story for Science and Spirit on the origins of baseball, where people in the Dominican Republic say that it started there, and that Doubleday was a plagiarist. Who knew? And so those were the kinds of things I had been doing for Giberson, and he had been organizing an open theology conference in Boston, and Polkinghorne was going to be one of the speakers. And Giberson had this idea of a book-length project about Polkinghorne. Polkinghorne had written 30-some books about being both a physicist and an Anglican priest. and that sort of convergence of faith and science in his own life and about theology and how the two are can be friends, not foes, as he would say. And so Guyverson asked me to come out and spend some time with Polkinghorne at this Open Theology Conference, which I did. And it was sort of like literary speed dating. It was just kind of seeing if we were compatible. And then at the end of that week, we talked about the possibility of doing a book together. And we both liked each other, and it worked out. So I started doing interviews with him, the first being at a God and the Laws of Nature conference at the Venice Institute. Some of you may have been there. So that's where I started my interview process with Polkinghorne. Then I got a sabbatical from Point Loma and a grant from the Templeton Foundation, and then another one from the Wesleyan Center here on our campus, and started visiting John in Cambridge for a couple of weeks at a time, off and on for about a year. We even traveled together to his old parish in Blean, England, where he had been the priest 25 years before, and he was going back there to be the visiting priest for a weekend. And I spent a week with him in Oxford at a conference called God and Physics, which was held in honor of his 80th birthday. And as if to underscore the perceived conflict between faith and science, which is the whole purpose of writing this book about him, when I got to the passport control booth at Heathrow Airport in London, the officer asked me why I was traveling to England. And I told him I was attending a conference at Oxford. And he said, what's the name of the conference? And I said, God and Physics. And he says, God and Physics, huh? Which side are you on? There you have it, right? Well, we had John come to Point Loma a year and a half ago, and I took him to the Creation Museum out here in Santee. I hope you've all been there since you've been here. I just wanted to show you. There we are. And only John Polkinghorne would wear a shirt like that at the Creation Museum. And so we hung out there for part of a day. He seemed, you know, interested, occasionally delighted. Here we are in the model Garden of Eden, which shows each day. And, you know, Polkinghorne's whole discussion about evolution and things like that has to do with mutations. And so I just wanted to make sure I got him under a sign that said mutations are bad. I've never published these, by the way. And here's one that says natural selection fails. And evolutionists of the 19th century. Darwin's in there. Karl Marx is in there. If you look at the next wall, which he just wouldn't pose for me in front of that one. Hitler's on the next wall. I told him they were leaving room for, you know, Polkinghorne's photo to be up there before too long. And so I just wanted to show you that we did spend some time there. And at a number of these different places where many of the things, the displays, were completely contradicting what John has written and believed and thought and said publicly, you know, I was constantly just saying in his ear, "Aren't you ashamed of yourself, John? Aren't you ashamed of yourself for being so wrong?" And after several of these lame attempts of mine, he finally turned to me and said, "I'm afraid my British reticence will not rise to your constant baiting." I thought, if you're going to get smacked down by a guy like that, you know, and with a British accent. And that's pretty much how it was to work with him on this book, too. I used every journalistic ploy I knew. I wrote for the New York Times for 15 years, and you know, I worked every possible angle with him. And sometimes I was successful. He took an uncharacteristic whack at Richard Dawkins in one of these interviews and then seemed surprised to see it in print. Apparently, you know, some of my baiting worked, you know, occasionally. And, you know, and when he said it, I knew it was one of those golden moments that, that for a journalist anyway. I had worn him down just enough, you know. I had to work for those. But I wrote about him for several newspapers and magazines, especially since he was going to be coming to San Diego. And the North County Times newspaper, North County of San Diego, published a Q&A that I did with him, and then they did a really, really glowing review on this book that I did about him, Quantum Leap. But the editor of the paper is a committed Christian. He's a big Kathleen Norris fan, and he thinks Polkinghorne is one of the greatest people in the world. So does Bill Moyers, by the way, who is also very open about his faith. And in fact, Moyers is considering having Polkinghorne featured in his new television program. So some news organizations were very, very open to writing about and publishing about Polkinghorne and his value in the whole faith and science conversation. But my experience in writing about Polkinghorne for the magazine, the Saturday Evening Post, was completely different. The editor I worked with there loved the story, encouraged it all the way, and praised it. But then that editor left the country for a conference, and another editor was then responsible for finishing off the magazine. And I got a call from that editor who told me he wanted to spike the story, not run it at all. And he had done a Google search on John Polkinghorne and found an anecdote about Polkinghorne on the BioLogos website, which I had written, by the way. I had written that post. But it was an anecdote that I repeated in the Saturday Evening Post story, and it was a minor part of the Post story, but that repetition, according to the magazine editor, meant that the story wasn't original, so he wanted to dump it. I thought it was kind of an irrational thing, and we went back and forth for a couple of days, and then I finally heard from the original editor that I was working with, and he told me off the record, and of course I'm telling you now, so we just can't keep secrets, but he told me off the record that the reason this conflict, well, it wasn't about that anecdote at all, it was because that editor felt like writing about faith and science in the same story was just unacceptable. That the two things had no business being talked about in the same discussion, in the same conversation, in the same article, and was doing whatever he could to keep that story from appearing. The story still appeared over the objections of that other editor. Interestingly, I haven't been successful in pitching the Saturday Evening Post in any other stories. And the one science writer at the UT San Diego, the major newspaper here in San Diego, used to be called the Union Tribune, he wouldn't even consider doing a story on John Polkinghorne and his visit here because, as one of his colleagues told me later, he felt like faith had nothing to do with science. It's not a story. It's not a story. I ended up getting a feature writer at the UT to do the story on Polkinghorne instead. The paper itself wasn't against it. It was the science writer who was against this idea. So, you know, these things, I'm sure you got several anecdotes that are that fit in this kind of thinking as well. The behavioral science editor at a major science magazine, I was talking with him on the phone just a couple of days ago about this time I was going to be having with you, and he was telling me about a story he did on, I don't know how many of you have seen Tracy Luhrmann's new book called When God Talks Back. She's an anthropologist who spent years with the non-denominational church, the Vineyard Church, and just did this from a very scientific anthropological study of what people are, how people come to know what they say they know about God. But she's coming at it from a very, very scientific point of view and has really a couple of really interesting chapters on prayer. And also then looking at different studies about the same part of the brain being used when you hallucinate are the same parts of the brain of when you pray. And it's called When God Talks Back. I highly recommend it. But this science editor, who is not a Christian, was writing a story on this kind of on this stuff about hallucination and prayer and things like that. And his editor-in-chief wanted absolutely nothing to do with that story appearing in this major science magazine. You know, the editor felt that since it talked about people's religious beliefs, it had no place, zero, in the scientific magazine. Well, the conclusion I've come to is that people tend to get pretty irrational when it comes to talking about science and faith. And some of the most irrational ones are members of the news media. And I say this as a member of the news media. There are plenty in the faith community, too, who are irrational, and occasionally one or two in the science community. But since journalists are trained to seek other points of view, I'm always surprised when I experience it in the journalism world. Now, here are some recent stories that I think involve both science and religion, where both subjects are present, clearly present, but maybe not as prominent as they both could be. Stories about climate change, for instance. Those involve both faith dimensions and science dimensions. Environmentalism, the end of the world and Harold Camping, Higgs boson, circumcision, both male and female, brain science, gay therapy, natural disasters, stem cell research, vaccinations and autism, human genome. You know, there are all sorts of things that include both faith and science dimensions, and oftentimes you will only see one of those in that coverage. As a longtime journalist and a longtime journalism professor, I think what I can do this morning is give you a little bit of guidance in helping navigate the journalism world and its occasional irrationality, and maybe give you a better understanding of how it works. And maybe help then get your perspective, get your story maybe considered a little more seriously. And even though there have been lots of changes in the news media in recent years, and there are still some generally agreed upon criteria, I think, in how news organizations make their decisions in what to cover and what not to cover. So I'll give you six or seven criteria of what are used and maybe explain a little about each. The first one has to do with conflict. And we all know that sort of intuitively, that conflict is what's interesting. That's true in fiction, and it's true in news stories. This is the obvious one. So stories about climate change, evolution, science textbooks, countless other stories are interesting in part because of the conflict that's involved. The drawbacks to conflict being the main reason why this story is being done are obvious as well. It can quickly become sort of a he said, she said kind of a story, and then it's just one group shouting at the other group, sort of like the presidential campaign coverage that we see, right? There's not a lot of depth or actual substance to a lot of that coverage. This is why I like the religion writer for NPR, Barbara Bradley Haggerty. I like her stories a lot because the model that she uses in her stories is not just he said this and he said that and now we have a balanced story. No, what she likes to do, and this is the image that she told me that that she has in her mind when she is approaching a story. She says it's more like a boxing match or a wrestling match, where you get some ideas, you introduce these ideas, and sometimes they're in conflict, oftentimes they're in conflict, and you put them in the ring, and then the listener gets to hear those ideas kind of grapple with one another. Some ideas clearly have the upper hand, and some other ideas are trying to claw themselves into the ring. You can hear that in her coverage, but you have no idea what she thinks, which is as it should be. And I think a classic example of that, if you want to go back and listen to it sometime, is her Adam and Eve story from last fall. it's a great example of these ideas kind of wrestling with each other. Or her more recent story about evangelicals and the failed efforts to cure gay people. It isn't a shouting match. It's a wrestling match. And in that conflict can be a real enlightening kind of sense from the audience. And a dominant idea might emerge. Anything Richard Dawkins says gets attention because it's usually associated with some kind of conflict. And I'll come back to Dawkins in a moment. So conflict is clearly one of the criterion for news coverage, or at least getting the attention of the news media. Another one has to do with impact and consequence. This criterion deals with just how important is this? Whatever it is we're talking about, how important is it? A story about a new obesity drug is going to have a lot more impact and consequence on audiences than a new drug or a new molecule that deals with something that affects a smaller number of people. A story about non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, for instance, is not going to get the same kind of play in the news media as an obesity drug will, because of the sheer impact and consequence, the sheer numbers involved. A story that has broad impact is going to drive news interest. All right? The third one, and this is probably as important as the conflict model in news media, has to do with novelty, something that's unusual. In the news media, firsts, lasts, and onlys are really, really interesting to us. And so if things are put in that kind of language, that's going to be of more interest than other things. A new study, a new drug, a new therapy, a new finding, the end of something. Those are interesting. Now here's where you have to kind of think about this. Just because they're interesting doesn't necessarily mean they're important, and they don't always have impact and consequence. And sometimes they're not even true, but at least for a time. And we've all seen stories like that, a new finding, a new drug, a new therapy, something like that. And a couple of days later, we find out, well, it wasn't even true. But it was interesting, and it was attention-getting for a while. That's all we need. The problem, of course, is that when something is touted as against conventional wisdom, for instance, while it's interesting, sometimes it's just flat out wrong. And this is where, journalists just fall for this kind of stuff all the time. Cold fusion. Oh, my gosh. some of these aren't important, but they are interesting briefly. And I call them didja stories, where somebody can say to somebody else, did you hear about that story, about they developed a two-headed chicken? The editor of Science News said that journalists most want to write about a scientific paper when it is the first report of a particular finding, when it describes an advance in hot research that is of wide interest, and when it contradicts a previous finding or belief. Okay, that all makes sense, but now listen carefully to what he says next. But these are the papers most likely to be wrong. Isn't that interesting? So we'll jump on these things as kind of new findings and stuff, but oftentimes, as you've seen, they can be wrong. Another criterion has to do with prominence. If somebody important says something or does something, we just mindlessly report it. And this is where Dawkins comes in. It's one thing if you make a public proclamation about something. A few people might listen. It's a whole other thing when Dawkins does. Once a person reaches a certain celebrity status, pretty much anything he or she says will get some attention, even if what that person says is dumb, wrong, or dull. He falls into the category, in my opinion, of heat for heat's sake, not heat for light's sake. But that doesn't matter. He's a rock star. For example, on this, if you make a proclamation, if you or I were to say to someone that we think that the laws for marijuana possession in this country are too severe, and we ought to lighten up on these laws a little bit, nobody would pay attention to that. But Pat Robertson said it, and oh my gosh, it was astonishing. Vicente Fox said it, and it was astonishing. It was big news because somebody who already has a platform, a sizable platform, said something, and we pay attention to that. I think it's interesting how religion and science come together in coverage about the Dalai Lama. Now, there's a case where, you know, prominence, he uses this to a great advantage. He's very committed to science and brain mapping and any new development that helps people understand consciousness, compassion, humanity. And in the stories that I've done on him, I've been delighted to see how totally unafraid of science he is as a religious figure. Not all religious leaders embrace science as broadly as he does, and I think we could learn a lot from watching him. Another criterion has to do with proximity. We hear a lot in local media here in San Diego. We hear a lot about what drug companies are doing and their research that's going on here in San Diego, primarily because a lot of that research is being done right here in La Jolla. If a local scientist does something and a local company does something, that's going to get attention here. Now, something big, like the Higgs boson announcement, that's got a much broader reach, impact and consequence, for instance. But the local media will still look for some sort of a local angle. In fact, television programs here, this is how desperate we are for local angles. Television news here showed footage of scientists in La Jolla watching their computer screens when they were making the announcement in Switzerland. That's news, baby. That's news. Anyway, proximity is going to have something to do with whether something is covered. Timeliness is another criterion. You know, it has to be something relatively recent. We used to talk about a 24-hour news cycle when cable television came along. We don't even talk in terms of 24-hour news cycle anymore. In the age of Twitter, there is no cycle. There's only now. It's all about now. And if it isn't reported right away, then the news value fades quickly. Higgs boson, for instance, is ancient history now, as far as the news media are concerned. And then the final criterion I would bring up would be the dimension of human interest. Journalists are interested in stories that help us understand what it means to be a human being. There was a recent story in the New York Times about a group of researchers whose director was diagnosed with a rare form of leukemia, I think it was, and he was clearly going to die without some kind of treatment. And the researchers began treating him with the very molecules they were trying to develop in their lab. And that's what saved his life. Now, that's an interesting science story, but it's a human interest story as well. And that's, I think, something of great interest to the news media. Now, you can see how a lot of these criteria overlap. Many stories are going to involve a lot of these criteria, but one is probably going to be the dominant reason for why this story got chosen over another. Now, here are some things that reporters are not very good at. And this is where you've got to be, you've just got to be mindful of that if you're dealing with them. We're not very good at nuance. We're not very good at context. And we're not very good about complicated stories. But that's not always our fault. That's a space issue sometimes. For instance, if it's the Atlantic Monthly or the New Yorker, you know, reporters can go into a deep dive with you. But most can't, especially television. And that's just not what they do. And one of the, you know, the faster growing news outlets is this patch.com. I don't know how many of you see it, but it's hyper-local, so that there will be a patch.com site just for Point Loma. Not for San Diego, but just for Point Loma. And a separate one just for Ocean Beach. Well, it's 2 miles from here. So all of their news is going to be just from there. And they have maybe a 300-word maximum word count for their stories. So a lot of the way that the news media are going, especially with their online stuff, nuance and complication and context aren't going to be as considered as much as we would like. But I thought what I'd do is just give you some ways to help in your kind of in the cause of getting some news coverage, or maybe helping news coverage be more complete. And I understand you're going to be hearing from a public relations person, I think it's tomorrow, on how to get your message out. So there may be some overlap here, but let me just give you some advice on maybe how to work with people like me. A lot of people think that the news media are biased, politically biased. And depending on your own political persuasion, you are absolutely convinced that they are biased in favor of the opposing party. Okay, we all know people who think like that. Generally, I don't think that's true. Some alleged reporters wear their bias on their sleeves, but I honestly don't consider them journalists. They're more a modern version of pamphleteers. You know, 200 years ago, there was a news outlet, a pamphlet for every political party in this country, and there were dozens. And so some news organizations and some particular journalists are more in the old style of pamphleteers, not what I would consider journalists. But here's the bias that all reporters tend to have, and that is they tend to oversimplify. And that isn't a political bias. That is just more a matter of they know that they've got some constraints they have to work with. That's just the nature of the beast. Attempts at balance end up distorting the real story. And this is the reason why I liked writing for the New York Times for as long as I did. I could get in depth with most of the stories that I did with them, but very few reporters have that luxury. Barbara Bradley Haggerty from NPR, that Adam and Eve story was 7 minutes long. That's, in radio, that's the equivalent of a New Yorker kind of story that just keeps going endlessly. Let's go back to bias just for a second. We're all biased as human beings. Reporters are, and so are scientists. This is where John Polkinghorne was adamant on this point. We're all coming from somewhere, some vantage point, not necessarily a political one, but we're also, hopefully, open to evidence, or at least the good ones are. Polkinghorne resonated very deeply with Michael Polanyi's work, especially when he talked about motivated belief. That the beliefs of scientists motivate them to interpret observations one way and others to interpret observations another way. Thus, the Creation Museum. Last year, I interviewed the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg at the University of Texas. He's an atheist and quite vocal in his opposition to people of faith. And interestingly, he and Polkinghorne are quite good friends. But I asked Weinberg about a specific quote of his that I lifted out of a debate that he did with Polkinghorne at the Smithsonian several years ago. And here's the verbatim quote that Weinberg gave in this debate. He said, "We don't believe in quarks because anyone has seen one. We believe in quarks because the theories that include them work." Now, I think that's a fascinating statement. I've thought about that for a long, long time, ever since I heard him say it. So I asked Weinberg, when I interviewed him, if given that statement, he could see how Polkinghorne could believe in one set of unseen realities in the world of physics and believe in another set of unseen realities as a priest. And Weinberg just laughed. He just laughed and said, "Of course not. One had to do with science, and the other had to do with religion, which has nothing to do with science. The two have nothing to do with each other." Well, that's motivated belief, if you ask me. You come from somewhere, some vantage point. There's a lot of bias out there. And if you want to see the knives really come out, mention the Templeton Foundation. Oh, my. The hostility toward them is palpable. I asked Barbara Bradley for some advice on talking to you when I was told her I was going to be talking to you, and here's what she said. She said, if you're going to be dealing with the news media, if you're a Christian and you're a scientist and you're trying to deal with the news media, here's the advice from, I think, one of the greatest reporters in America. She said, don't lead with your faith. Don't lead with your faith. Don't bury it. Now, keep in mind, Barbara Bradley is a very devout Christian, a born-again Christian, just like many of you, just like me. But she's saying that's not what you want to lead with when you're dealing with the news media. Don't even mention it for a while. Lead with your power of thinking. That's what's interesting. She also said, don't be political. And in her view, this is where the intelligent design movement went wrong. They were very political from the very, very beginning. She said, have all of your data from a respected journal. She said, approach religion reporters, not just science reporters. As far as she's a religion reporter, she said, we can grasp stuff if you can explain it. That's not bad advice, you know. Then she also said, and make sure you have some sort of what's called a news peg. Why is this interesting? Why is it interesting now? Anything will work for a news peg. An anniversary of something will work. And she said this: religion reporters are scared of science because they're afraid of getting something wrong. This is where you can actually help them. And science reporters are dismissive of faith. But Francis Collins helps. Polkinghorne helps. But this is, I'm just telling you, this is what you're up against. Now, I'm just going to give you some of my own advice here. So you heard from Barbara Bradley. Now let me give you some advice. Those of you who have not done so already, I would suggest that you develop a blog. Clear writing will get you very, very far with the news media. And get some help with making your blog look interesting. Just because you know how to go on WordPress or Blogspot and start putting data in there or putting text in there doesn't mean it's going to look very good. Get some help. Pay for it. Hire a pro. Clear thinking, by the way, is better than ranting. Ranting might get you quoted occasionally, but it won't give your ideas the respect that they deserve. I would also develop relationships with other bloggers. They get noticed. Bloggers get noticed. And believe it or not, reporters read blogs all the time. They're always looking for blogs in their field. Develop relationships with reporters. You all have reporters in your hometowns, regardless of how small. And if you're in big cities, they're still very, very approachable. Read their stuff. Read their stuff. Leave comments on their stories. Again, remember the ranting rule. But leave comments for them. Be kind to them. The reason Barbara Bradley became a Christian is that she was working on a story. This is before she was a believer. She was working on a story, and the people, she was working on mega churches in Southern California. That was the story. And it was because the people she was writing about were kind to her and actually ministered to her at a particular time in her life. She became a believer because of the treatment that she got from her sources. Keep that in mind. Groom your local contacts. And then look at other outlets. Look at the Huffington Post, for instance. Look at all the bloggers that they have. Pitch ideas to them. Pitch ideas to the Religion News Service. They've got stuff to fill. Remember, there's no cycle here. They're always interested in something, as well as your local outlets as well. And I don't know how many of you are members of an organization called HARO, H-A-R-O. Anybody a member of that? I didn't think so. And you know what? You really could be. And it's an acronym for Help a Reporter Out. I'm serious. This is started by reporters who just, they need sources. So if you sign up for H-A-R-O, HARO.com, if you go to HARO and put yourself in there, then when reporters are working on a particular story, on any given topic, cancer research or, you know, whatever, gene therapy, whatever, and your name is up there, somebody's very possibly going to contact you. And once you get quoted in some of these stories, it's interesting, reporters read other reporters' stuff, and so pretty soon you'll be getting contacted by others as well. That happened to me. I was quoted in the New York Times recently, a couple of years ago, about the future of journalism, and I made some proclamation. And just on the basis of that quote, I got invited to be a presenter at a University of Massachusetts big national conference on the future of journalism. Why? Because they saw my quote in the New York Times. These people didn't know me. So, you know, 7 months later, I'm at Amherst doing a presentation on the future of news. So getting yourself as a source out there is actually very, very beneficial to you. There's also an organization called ProfNet, P-R-O-F-N-E-T. Join ProfNet. There's a very good chance, if you're associated with a university, there's a very good chance your university already does that. And so make sure that that you're connected with them. When you do a blog, enhance it. Enhance it with video or animation. Get some help. Again, those of you who are involved with students, oh my gosh, they're all over this stuff. You want to explain a difficult scientific proposition? Get some student to animate it for you and put it on your blog. You will get noticed. And have a good relationship with your university's marketing department. Have them send out alerts to the media. So, the first thing to understand, let me just start to wrap this up this way, is you can't get very complicated in your explanations or interviews. Boil it down. Reporters aren't stupid. You don't have to dumb it down, but you do have to be clear. You'll get noticed by being clear. And I know that all of you got your degrees because of your ability to obfuscate. Okay, I know that. I know that. That's how I got my degree. I could just obfuscate faster than most. But in this kind of a field, though, obfuscation is going to be problematic. You're going to get misquoted. It's going to get misunderstood. But I also understand the flip side of that, that the ones who can speak to the masses in your, you know, in your fields, the ones who can speak to the masses get criticized for being popularizers. I understand that. I understand that. But you know what that is? That's just jealousy. That's all that is. But you've got to be clear. Many reporters do not understand the difference between causation and correlation. And many of them do not understand statistics. And you've got to help them. Help them see that there's more to the story. I think you've got a story to tell. Sometimes it's about science. Sometimes it's about science and faith. And if I learned anything from John Polkinghorne, it's that there's no clinching argument for your faith. This is from my talking with him. He said, it's not a knockdown argument. Our faith is not a knockdown argument, he would say. Beliefs are hard to communicate. And as soon as we start speaking with certainty, which is very quotable, by the way, we leave ourselves open to misinterpretation and sensationalism and invite that kind of model for news coverage, conflict model for news coverage. But remember this concept of motivated belief. So Polkinghorne says to me, am I comfortable with ambiguity? He said, I'm more uncomfortable with spurious clarity. Almost all reductionist accounts chop off the ends that don't fit. He's right. Now, that's the question that drives most of us, believers and journalists. Is it true? We should approach that question two-eyed, Polkinghorne says, one with the eye of faith, one with the eye of science and evidence. Testing everything, holding fast to what is true. What I appreciated most about hanging out with John Polkinghorne is that he's the first to admit that our understanding of science, our, the universe, and God might all be wrong. Isn't that interesting? So let me end with this quote from John Polkinghorne. But what else can you do? There is the mystery of God, the strangeness of God. Nevertheless, we hold on. That's John Polkinghorne, and I think that's sort of where we're living as well. So what I'd like to do is, if you want to engage in any of this and have some question time. I'm not sure I've got answers. I don't have spurious clarity. But I would be happy to talk with you, if you want, about news media kind of stuff or John Polkinghorne or whatever. We've got people with microphones who will, talk to you. So this would be a good time to we'd use our final minutes together talking about that. Oh, thank you.
I appreciate your remarks about being involved with things like PropNet and also in the privileged position where a former science student is right now a reporter for the New York Times.
Good.
So the conflict that I have is that since I've gotten involved in this in terms of speaking to the media, because it's through a large secular research university, there's a sense that I have that I should be extremely careful in what I say, in that it's not just my own opinions or my desire to elucidate writing professionally, but also in some quasi sense, being a representative of the institution.
Yeah.
And so, when it comes to the technical parts of what I do, and conveying the excitement and all that kind of good stuff about what I do as a scientist, there's no problem. But I'm still thinking through about then how it relates to what I also am eager to talk about, in which I talk in other contexts about, and in my faith as a scientist. And so it's not really kind of a question, but also something that you might want to reflect on.
Yeah. No, and that's a very real dilemma for, I would say, for all research, all researchers. When I do a story, for instance, for the New York Times or something like that, I'm not going to. I'll give you an example. I was part of the New York Times coverage here in a suburb in northern San Diego County called Rancho Santa Fe. This is, 12 or 15 years ago, of this Heaven's Gate mass suicide. 39 people, killed themselves to follow an invisible spaceship behind the Hale-Bopp comet. And so I was part of the news coverage of that. I was one of the first reporters to that house where those 39 people died. Now, in my coverage of that, no one knew that I was a believer. But because I was a believer, I think I had a much better insight into why people do things like that, or why they believe things like that. I don't believe in the spaceship, obviously, but we've got, as Christians, we've got some wacky beliefs that are hard to explain, to people who are not in that. But my point is, I think I had a perspective that a lot of the other news media did not have, where they just said, these guys are crazy. And I'm thinking to myself, no, actually, I think it's a little more complicated than that. And so I think I came into to my coverage of that with a little more empathy and compassion for what they did. And so at no point did my faith, become part of that story, but it helped inform my story, right? And that's where I think maybe in your case, the research that you do, it helps inform your research. And then, when you speak to other groups, you can talk about your faith and things like that. But unless it's part of the story, it probably won't be mentioned. And a lot of secular universities are very skittish about, how out there with your faith that you are. That's true with journalists and professors as well. But you've got a very real dilemma, and I can appreciate it.
Let me just make a follow-up question and comment.
Sure.
I think academic freedom is really designed to protect the professor, but it's also intended to protect the university.
Mm-hmm.
And the university wants to have the public know when professors speak, they're not speaking on behalf of the university,
yeah,
unless they're officially commissioned to do so. Because there are lots of wacky things that professors say.
Yeah.
I thought the secular university for 30 years, and I always felt pretty free. I didn't want to say wacky things.
Yeah.
I wasn't speaking on behalf of the university, where
right,
it was appropriate. I really felt like it was perfect assignment. to bring in the macrospective
right.
from a Christian point of view. So I think that
the context matters, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it doesn't matter if you depends on how you commit yourself. I'm my president speaking on behalf of the university,
right.
I have to be very careful when I say the board of trustees.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm a ranking professor way down in the ranks, then that freedom is to protect me and to protect the university.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, good, good, thank you. Right. Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. When you are doing the Haro thing or the ProfNet thing, you probably, at least in the public's eye, you may be associated with the university, not speaking as an individual. So yeah, you probably do need to be really mindful of what you say. Yeah, no, that's an excellent point.
Hi, my name is Pamela Day. I'm a staff writer online as a blogger and a podcaster.
Good for you.
I would say it is necessary that our community blogs, and some of you heard me preach this several times this weekend. Science blogs is a nest of scientists who are speaking good science and turning around and proselytizing for atheism. Free Thought Blogs is a network of new atheists. I haven't yet been able to identify the network of scientists who are Christians who are blogging. And so folks like Neil deGrasse Tyson are able to communicate to the public that we believe when they say that education leads to atheism and good scientists are atheists. And we are in a position to combat that. Now, having said that, I'd add a couple of cautions. Don't actually hire a professional designer at $150 an hour, and we'll leave you with a blog you can't maintain. Subscribe to one of the things like Blue Themes or Elegant Themes that will allow you to have a sharp design. And don't work with your university if you're going to say anything that won't be within your university's party lines. I've been formally interviewed before, and my blog is Science and Academia, and several faculty have lost their jobs to blog.
Yeah, it's speaking of academic freedom, you know, that's a pardon? Yeah, perhaps. I'm coming to the conclusion that academic freedom is a myth anyway, and so these are really important points about this. You do have to be careful who you're representing here. Are you representing yourself? And if that's the case, then yeah, your blog should be separate. My blog, for instance, is separate from the university. And, you know, that I think that's probably appropriate. Uh-huh.
When reporters are looking for sources, for good reason, they're looking for credible
yeah.
resources or authorities in that field. For early career people who may have not tenured yet, mm-hmm. still getting into the field, but want to serve a role in being a resource for reporters and sort of helping in public understanding of science, is there a new bullet that you can bring in?
Oh yeah, I think the because you're in the cutting edge stuff. You're in the newer things that are being dealt with, and so I would if I were you, I would try to develop some sort of relationship with people of your local news media. I don't know where you live, but everybody has some aspect of the news media. You know, whether it's an online only or whatever. But yeah, I think if you became kind of known as the go-to person when a science thing comes up. So, for instance, local news outlet is looking for some kind of a local angle on Higgs boson. Why do we care about that in Fresno? Well, what if we've got a local science person who can kind of put some kind of a spin from a local place, then they're, that's how you're going to develop that. And then as bigger things come up, you will have had this experience then of dealing with the news media. That's how I'd do it. Okay?
So we're out here having this great weekend.
Where are you? Oh, okay.
Science
yeah.
and yeah. faith and the media.
Right.
I mean, how much more fascinating can you get? So why isn't Barbara Bradley Haggerty out here covering us?
Yeah, we're not that interesting. I actually talked to her about it and suggested that she might. But I hate to even hear myself say this. But I really do think there is an East Coast bias. You know, if this were happening a little closer to Washington, if this were happening a little closer to Boston or New York, I think your chances might be a little greater. I'm not sure about that. But I think it's great. But it's the people like Barbara Bradley Haggerty who would be interested in something like this. But as I showed you, or as I explained it in my Polkinghorne frustration, the local science writer for the UT San Diego would say this is just a crock. So that would be one of the reasons. Yeah, I think it's newsworthy, but who am I?
Could you suggest a source on who consumes media, a breakdown of men and women, the different, you know, TV, radio, internet, social media,
yeah.
A source of statistics on who consumes
what kinds of media?
What types of people consume what kinds?
Well, we all consume media. I mean
statistics on who consumes more media of a different type.
Yeah.
Ages, men women.
Yeah, online stuff, obviously, there's an age demarcation of people who will only get news from online. And, you know, that's probably around 30 and below, maybe 35 and below. Yeah. Actually, and interesting. I think part of that same deal is the fastest growing demographic group for Facebook is women over 65. That's kind of interesting. Now, obviously, there's a problem. I'm going to give you my own bias about online only kinds of media. The New York Times did a study where they looked at how much time does the average person spend with a hard copy of the actual paper, the tree-killing version of the New York Times? And it was about 45 minutes. And then they did, because you can measure eyeballs and stuff on a screen. What's the average amount of time that people spent on the New York Times website? 45 seconds. So, you know, when we're talking about stuff that needs nuance and context and stuff like that, we have a challenge. We have a challenge, but online is obviously where it's at. Sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
And I think that part of that is a problem of credentials. And, you know, we young science writers especially, you know, the scientists are already wary of the media.
Right.
They think you're stupid, too.
Yeah,
And you basically don't have the plan to get the, you know, the sources that you need.
Yeah.
So I feel like, you know, going to science writers at newspapers or your science stories, if you want any kind of efficient angle, is probably a failing strategy at this point.
Yeah.
Because unless it's a newspaper that covers religious ideas and stuff like that, because, I mean, it just seems to me, having been in that community, this trend is even way worse. Just parking yourself with the atheist, because at least the atheist in the, you know, mindset of the scientist, at least they know what they're. You know,
yeah.
That's sad and it's scary, but, you know, older generations of journalists, and maybe you have some advice for ASA members for how to find a sympathetic journalist in the landscape of the news media. It's very opaque to us.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, there's an interesting organization called the Religion News Writers Association, RNA, and probably wouldn't be a bad idea to just join them, you know, because for you, I'm talking about, because then you're kind of in this group of people who at least are comfortable covering issues about religion and about faith. They might not all be believers, but in fact, many of them are. But that's at least their beat, and they're comfortable with that. So that may be probably the window. Yeah, it's I think it's rna.org, but it's called the Religion News Writers Association. And that may be the route in. And as I mentioned before, my success with getting something about John Polkinghorne in the North County Times was simply because the editor-in-chief was a believer. And my lack of success at the UT here in San Diego was because the science writer was not. But there's a way to get around that. And this is my point. Polkinghorne's interesting because he's interesting, not because he's got a particular religious slant that I think everybody wants to know. So that's why a feature writer. So there were ways to get around this, the anti-faith bias. I love what Polkinghorne says about atheists. He says, atheists aren't stupid. He said, they just explain less. Wow. Yeah.
Scientific American is one of the major outlets for the public.
Material.
My experience in the years of subscribing is that they give those reviews often and like the term of the skeptic. I wonder if you've had any interaction with their editorial staff or whether they're going to put them doing anything more favorable to the city.
Probably not. I mean, I have had some experience with them and with Science Magazine. But you know what? It all depends. This is why I'm saying develop relationships with writers, with reporters. Because the science reporter at the Fresno Bee eventually is going to become a science writer with the Scientific American or with Science Magazine or something. And that's why I'm saying if you can develop some sort of a relationship with a journalist, those people move around some. But even at Scientific American, if you see something that somebody did well at Scientific American, and you email that person and say, that was a really good story, and I'm going to start paying attention to your stuff from now on, you never know what's going to come out of that. And I think that's the Christian thing to do anyway, you know, regardless of the fact that you've got a hidden motive. So that's how I would do it. Rather than just say Scientific American has a bias against Christians, I would get much more personal and say, okay, who are some individuals who might be sympathetic to some of the stuff I'm thinking about? Yeah, please. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. No. There you go. Have you done this one yet? Well, come on. What are you waiting for? Yeah. 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 Well, and don't just do that, though. Tell them why you're dropping your subscription. You know, they actually pay attention to that stuff. And advertisers pay attention to these things as well. But yeah, you've got to go where there's going to be a little more sympathetic reception to what you're trying to say. Hmm? Yeah.
Several months ago, I channeled to avoid a commercial, and the channel that I switched to was a network that was completely deployed, and thus continues the annual battle between science and religion. How would you suggest getting through to these guys that that is not an appropriate template to end every scientific argument?
Well, now we're back to sort of that conflict model, you know, that this is, it's just easier to talk about complicated things in this either or, this kind of dualistic kind of thinking.
Is there a way to convince them that integrity is more important than sensationalism?
No, because sensationalism is interesting. Who cares about integrity? Yeah, I think what you can always do is leave a comment. Because whatever that was, I'm sure it was also posted online. You can leave a comment on there, and maybe that starts a conversation, or maybe you contact the reporter herself or himself or whatever, and say, you know what, that isn't necessarily, you know, how it is. That may be a way to do it. Or in your own blog post, refer to it and say and give your take. But you're not going to get the major news media to stop saying that there's this conflict.
I know there's many more questions. We're going to go ahead and wrap it up so that I'm sure exit stage.
Have they gone through metal detectors or anything like that?
Yes. And so you can continue the conversation with Dean, and then of course we have lunch coming up. So let's thank our speaker once again.
Yeah, thank you very much.